anything.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network. After my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss. And I guess the weatherman got this wrong today because it's beautiful outside, thank God. Before I introduce the author, I promised someone I would announce this. There are so many animals in the world that need love and attention and help. So we are so delighted to announce the date for the 7th Pause to Love Pet Adoption Festival for shelter animals and rescue groups. The event will take place on May 19, 2019, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on the grounds of Minetta Hill Animal Hospital. It was such a successful event in the past years that we are happy to announce that over 85 dogs have been adopted as a result of the festival. There can be music, vendors, food, everything, pets to adopt, and several rescues have already confirmed that they will be in attendance this year. My niece Tammy Forcell is a contact person, and I'm really proud to announce this. And I'm even more excited today because we have the author of Below the Fold, R.G. Belsky, is here. And I was very proud this morning because I gave him his first golden 5 stars. Good morning. How you doing?
It's a good day all around so far. You said the weather's nice. I woke up to a nice review from you, and now here I am with you. And I get to talk for a whole hour because most of the time on the show I'm on a panel, which is great, but it's just me and you.
That's going to be fun because they told me I'm joining you on Friday, and I said, what?
On Marcia's show?
They said I'm there. Yeah, she asked me to be on the show too.
Oh,
and I'm
cool.
Gonna let you do
great.
I'm going to let you do the talking, and I'm going to just like listen.
Well, I will just warn people one thing here. I don't know if you may hear, they just stopped. I live, in the heart of New York City, Manhattan, and there's people working with jackhammers outside my apartment. So if you hear noise,
goody.
That's what it is.
I had that happen on one of my shows, and unfortunately the author was not happy because I was getting renovations, but I didn't know that they were going to renovate right behind my brain, and it wasn't my fault, but oh well, what can I tell you? So
we also got a lot of police sirens that go by on this street. So, it just gives you a little of the color. My book is set in New York, and this gives you a little of the color of New York City that can go with it,
I know. And I mean, we get them over here also up in Upper Westchester. So what can I say? And when I lived in the Bronx, we got them all the time, constantly. So we have Claire Carlson, and she's a strong character. I like her. And tell us a little bit about her backstory. And how did she begin her career as a reporter and a director?
So Claire Carlson, because I started out in newspapers, and then like a lot of people in today's media world, you wind up doing other stuff, whether it be digital or TV. And so Claire was a newspaper reporter and wins a Pulitzer Prize as a newspaper reporter. But then, the paper disappears and she winds up in TV. And, I talk in the first book about this because it is true of some people. It turns out she's not very good on television because she is a very tough lady, and she's, all these things that make her an interesting person kind of make her kind of grating on the TV screen, and the viewers are like, oh, we don't like these people. So she winds up getting behind the scenes, where she winds up now being the news director, where she's in charge of everybody. So, but she still misses being a reporter, which is kind of what happens in the book. So even though she's a news director, the novels aren't about her directing the news and doing budgets and ratings. She winds up getting involved herself in big stories because, she really is a newspaper reporter. And we can talk about this in a minute, but even the title of the book, Below the Fold, is really a newspaper term. It's not a television term.
I looked it up so I would make sure that I had it right. See, I got it right on my review, too. I made sure that I knew what it below the fold meant. That's just
well,
me.
Below the fold, you know, below the fold basically is a reference to a story, and it's from the old newspaper days that is not important enough to make it to the top of the front page. So it's kind of below the fold, and you know, and that, as you know, that is the basis of what this book is about. It's about the kinds of murders that are covered in the media, and this involves the kind of murder that normally wouldn't be covered in the media, the murder of a homeless person on the streets of New York City.
Yeah.
And but amazing things, you know, happen once my character, Claire Carlson, decides, well, I'm not going to follow the rules. I'm going to look into this murder that isn't really worth anything, but it turns out to be a sensational story.
Well, that's an important issue, the homeless in New York City and everywhere. And That's what I found captivating when I started to read. I go, oh my God, this poor lady's homeless. Nobody cares. But I knew I knew there had to be more to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I didn't. You know, when you write stories, sometimes you know, like it's not like I set out to do a story about the issue of the homeless. Although I live in New York, so I see it a lot. I basically set out to do a story about a seemingly meaningless murder and a homeless person who at first you don't even know the name of, seemed, well, that kind of makes sense. And the thing about this is the kind of message that, you know, that I wanted to convey is that if you look hard enough, everyone has a story. Now, you know, you see, you find some homeless person who's like in her 50s, a drunk, an alcoholic, don't even know her name, and she's dead. And you say, well, there's no story there. But, you know, what Claire kind of feels and what I wanted to convey is, well, she once was somebody. I mean, she's nobody now, but she once was somebody. I mean, people don't just, you know, show up on the street at the age of 50. I mean, she was a little girl. She grew up. She had parents. She had hopes. She had aspirations. She probably was in love with people. And how did all that go awry, and how did she wind up the way she is? And that's the story that that Claire goes looking for in this, and it turns out to be a pretty incredible thing because it turns out that it involves all sorts of important, prominent people like politicians and, you know, the head of a media outfit and things like that. And, you know, again, I guess everyone has a story, but sometimes you have to look hard for it. You know, in the media, we generally focus on the incredibly high profile. I mean, all my career, I've been, you know, we'll do 24-hour cable news on, you know, O.J. Simpson or JonBenet or Casey Anthony and all these. And 99% of the crimes and murders really don't get covered. And you can't. It's impossible to do it. But every once in a while, if you actually look at one, you know, some interesting stuff can come out of it. And that's really what happens in Below the Fold.
Yeah, I know. It was interesting because it just everybody connected after a while, and wait till they figure out how they connected and how they're all connected. And I won't tell you if I figured it out. I'm not going to say a word.
Right. And you know, what I like to do, and I've done this in the first book too, is I like to, you know, go back in the past because a lot of the secrets that are uncovered here are from the past. So, you know, the important people, they obviously don't have any link with this homeless woman now, but they did, you know, 30 years ago or whatever when they were all – and they were all different people then. So, you know, the guy who was the guy who's a media baron now wasn't a media baron then. He was just a kid, you know, and growing up just like everybody else. So that's always fascinating, too, to be able to go back in the past and see how the events of the past, you know, were able to create this situation that you might have today.
Well, that's true. But we have a character that winds up dead right after her, and you get to know her, but you don't really like her.
No.
That was Grace Mancuso.
At the same time, Claire is attempting to look into this seemingly insignificant death. She gets an incredibly high-profile crime, which is a woman named Grace Mancuso, who's involved in a financial scam, sort of like a Bernie Madoff situation with a big financial firm where she's ripping off clients, and she's pretty and she's sexy and, you know, she's all these things that make an incredible high-profile murder. And there would seemingly be no connection between her and the dead homeless woman. But, you know, again, this is, you know, in the end, a lot of stuff links up. And the Grace Mancuso woman, and I'm kind of proud of, I think, of her, because I think in her I created possibly the most evil, unlikable person that I've ever done. And she's not alive at any point in the book, you know, because she's dead from the beginning of the book. She's murdered. But everything you find out about her makes you dislike her. And I think at the end of the book, without giving away any secrets, I talk about how even a lot of the people in the book who've done things wrong, they're flawed, but they still have some good characteristics. And the Grace Mancuso character, she's a very she just has no morals, no, you know, and she takes advantage of everybody for herself. Again, the book starts off with her murder, but you don't really understand what it has to do with anything, obviously, until you get well into the book. But I like Grace only because she, you know, like I say, she was so evil. I don't know that I've ever written a character that had absolutely no redeeming qualities, and I think she might qualify.
She does, and there are a lot of people in this world that follow in her footsteps, too. They would be so proud that she was there. No, seriously,
well,
I think I'm starting
too
to meet some of them.
I like the idea, too, you know, this idea of, you know, the classic. I mean, I actually made a reference to that. It's kind of like the, you know, the famous Agatha Christie story where everybody on the train killed the bad person, you know, killed the victim, you know, everyone on the train. And I think there's a reference to that about Grace Mancuso, that she had so many enemies, you know, they could have all gotten together and murdered her. So, I like that concept because, you know, the suspect list would be very, very long as to who wanted her dead.
Well, as we know, they found something at her murder scene that was absolutely original and clever. That's what got me. And then they have the list of Scott Manning, Brendan Kaiser, Emily, and the homeless lady, and Bill. So how did you create that list? And then I'm saying, like, how did they get connected? And then I'm saying, oh, maybe, I won't tell you if I figured it out, but it was absolutely brilliant. My God, really, seriously.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of, somehow I had to put it all together, and so when you find the body of Grace Mancuso, somebody has left a list with now she's a pretty important person, and someone else has left a list with like four or five other very either important or prominent people, but with nothing seemingly in connection, everyone from a media baron to a politician to a police officer to a lawyer, but then the one name on the list that doesn't fit is the homeless woman. So she's on the list too, and that kind of like was my way of saying to the reader, hey, this all is going to link together at some point. You just don't know how, and so that's the clue. The list that's left by the body, and that's when I think the story really begins, because up till then you're saying, well, what does one person have to do with the other? And you don't really get the answers until the end of the book. And I can't really talk about it, but you know the answers. And link up at the end. It does all link up at the end.
I am not going to tell anybody anything because I don't give away spoilers. And I was very, very, very impressed with myself because sometimes I'm going like, oh my God, what did I write? And I try really not to write anything that I shouldn't write. You know, you don't know. And then you say, oh, well, I don't think that's a spoiler, but somebody else says, oh my God, no. I think I read this over quite a number of times to make sure that I was right.
And you know, people who say to me, you know, talking about writing process, and which I think we've done a few times on the phone, but people always say, you know, well, how did you come up with that idea, or how did you figure that out, or something?
Yeah.
And the answer is, I don't. I mean, I do, but when I put that list next to Grace Mancuso's body, I didn't exactly know where that story was going at that point. But I knew, you know, somebody once wrote that, what, you know, you want to you want to throw up a lot of questions, and then you have to try and provide the answers. But you know, sometimes even as an author, I don't know exactly where that's going to go. And as you know from the book, there are several twists in the book that go on even after you think you know the answer. But then here's another wrinkle to this thing, and that's why I wanted to. You know, make the characters so kind of like layered and complex. I mean, the one character that they were all interesting in some way. Because I wrote them. But you know, the politician, he's basically a scandal-plagued politician. He was like a prominent congressman who got involved in a sex scandal with interns. You know, but he still has recovered, and now he's the president of a college, and he's kind of looking at a political future. And all this was based on the fact that I, as a reporter, because I've been a journalist for a lot of years, as you know, working at New York Post, New York Daily News, NBC News, you know, I covered all these. I covered, you know, everybody from Bill Clinton to Anthony Weiner to Donald Trump. My very first celebrity story in 1990 was covering Donald Trump's divorce to marry Marla Maples. So, you know, and all these people in some ways recovered. Even though Anthony Weiner went to jail, he still ran for mayor after he had a sex scandal, you know. So I've always been intrigued by this idea of politicians, you know, who kind of do this stuff and still can run for office. And so that was one of the more interesting characters that I think I created there in that guy.
Oh, you did, and all of them. But nobody's going to believe how clever it was when we figure out the link. That's what I'm going to say about that.
But so, as I said, you know, I just keep writing. I just basically kept writing it and tried to let the thing, you know, flow the way I thought. And I think to me, some writers, you know, plot the whole thing out. But to me, if you plot it out, it becomes a little more I feel like, oh, this is what's going to happen. If you kind of let the characters play it out and then you're like, whoa, what if they did that? I don't know. For me, anyway, it works out a lot more realistically. And I love it. I love it when a character does something I don't think they're going to. And I've said this about Claire Carlson. You know, I didn't necessarily set out to have Claire Carlson be exactly like she is. But, when you're writing successfully, the character will come alive. So there are times Claire will do or say something, and I'm like, holy, you know, I don't know if she should be doing that. But, you know, she does it, and then, you know, it's kind of fun for me, too, to see when that happens.
Well, what I love about her, which reminds me of me a lot, too, because I'm the same way. I want to do, I've been told that the last couple of days, lately, over whatever. And,
if but I want to know something. Somebody described her, and she has no filter whatsoever on her mouth. So I think that's a pretty good description.
That's what they told me yesterday, too. And I'm very proud to say that she and I could get along just fine. So we've got her friend Janet and Maggie.
Yeah.
And they keep her centered. And she's going to do this story, but how do they keep her? Well, she still goes off the rocker once in a while, but that's okay. So how do they keep her centered so she doesn't really mess up or say things and they'll tell her, well, you know, you got to think, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes you just say something and you don't realize it.
Yeah, so you got to create, you got to create a people around, a support group kind of, I guess, around her, I feel. There's, as you know, there's actually, I think, three people. So there's Maggie is her assignment editor, and she's this young, ambitious, editor. But she's actually the person that convinces Claire in the beginning to go after the homeless person, you know, story, because everybody's like, oh, nobody cares about that. And Maggie is the one who starts using quotes about how everybody has a story, and the quotes are something that Claire had once said. And as Claire said in the beginning, how can I argue with Maggie when somebody throws your own quotes back at you? You can't really argue with them, you know. And so Maggie's very smart like that and very focused on the job. Janet is like her best friend in the world. She's a lawyer, and I kind of can create this person who's the opposite of Claire in the sense that she's got it, kind of got it like balanced life and career. She's got a happy marriage. She's got kids. She's a successful lawyer. And so she and Claire get along great, but they're kind of opposites in terms of their lives. And she very much is the advice person for Claire in terms of personal stuff, you know. And, you know, I think one line I said in the original was that Janet actually, Claire's been married and divorced three times, and Janet was her lawyer in all three. And I point out, like, I think Claire says at one point, you know, that basically Janet could make a living just doing her divorce cases. But so they have this kind of relationship like that where Janet really understands Claire and kind of tries to rein her in when she gets too crazy. But sometimes it's professional, but with Janet it's more the personal. And the other person that, you know, is important in this book and in the previous book is her boss. So she has an executive producer named Jack mm-hmm. Farron. And, you know, I kind of point out that, you know, she considers him about the best kind of, as good as you can get with an executive producer. And then she then points out, well, the bar is not set very high because you have an awful lot of bad ones, but he's mm-hmm. basically, he gets exasperated with her, but he basically trusts her, and he's, you know, he's basically like her on her side. And he lets her get away with saying and doing a lot of things that most of us would never get away with saying or doing to our boss.
That's what I like about him too. I need somebody like that. But then again, I'm my own boss, so I could do it if I want.
At this point, you can only get mad at yourself then.
I know. I try so hard to manage me, but there are days I just am not manageable at all. That's what they tell me. So we've got Grace is gone, and she was a stockbroker, but the police were after her and her company, and they were under investigation. So
Yeah, and I make most of the people that at that company pretty horrible too, because you know it's very easy to to people who are dealing in big financial stuff to make them like not likable. So I mean, I think pretty much everybody there is, including Grace's boss, is pretty unlikable.
She is probably one of the most unlikable persons I've ever met, but that's okay because that's all right. Nobody has to like everybody.
I thought one of the scenes that I really liked doing was early on after she's dead, where Claire interviews her parents who come to New York to, you know, to deal with the funeral, and you realize that even her parents in the end didn't really like her because she had been so. So evil that she had even, you know, taken advantage of them. I mean, they cared because she was the daughter, but, you know, I mean, at one point the father says something like, I guess I should feel bad, worse than I did, than I do, but I don't. Like, basically, we lost her a long time ago.
She was, yeah, I know. I'm surprised that they even came back to bury her and just didn't leave her somewhere in a carton and just put her away.
Well, they had to because that's the only way I could write that scene. So, you know, I had to bring them back, you know. It is fiction, you know, so.
Oh, no. In real life, they might have just dumped her in a river. What can I tell you? But, okay, we've got the impression that, as you said, nobody in the company really misses her. Nobody misses her. So she had a relationship with Atwood.
Yes.
What was that about? She had a relationship with a lot of people.
Yeah, you're talking about with the senator guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What it's about is it depends from whose point you look at it. Atwood is a senator is like basically wants every pretty girl woman he can get, so he's attracted to her sexually. She is interested in him to take advantage of him, which is the reason
of
she's
course.
Interested in anybody. So that's the dynamic, and obviously that dynamic has some, you know, very interesting results at some point because they're different, you know, they're looking for different things. And then he's not looking to be in love with her. He's looking to have sex with her, and she's looking to get money out of him. And so that, of course, makes him a prime suspect at some point in her murder. In fact, he seems to be a pretty clear-cut suspect at some point. But, you know, again, it turns out everything turns out to be a lot more complex than it does. And what I enjoy doing is like making things seem relatively simple until you realize at some point, well, it's not that simple. Some of that is true, but there's more to it, and here's the new twist.
This is very true. So what is it? He's got a problem. He wants everybody to think he's wonderful. But now we've got another character. There's got Emily, and she wouldn't talk to Claire. Why? I mean, poor Claire had to go around
and
interview these people.
I thought she was an interesting character too. She's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And at the moment, she's a very high-powered lawyer. And at the moment, she's the kind of lawyer that everyone hates, you know, like the lawyer who will represent anybody. So she'll represent drug dealers, mob bosses, because they're big paydays. So she's really only in it for the money. And so in the beginning of the book, you know, she's this very powerful lawyer, and she seems to be just money-grubbing and have no morals. And Claire, you know, immediately dislikes her, except you find out as the book goes on, not unlike the homeless woman, she has a past too. And her past was she had started out as a very dedicated lawyer. She started working for people like the homeless and working for, you know, people who couldn't afford lawyers and working as a public defender because she really, like, had all these principles. And then something happened. She was betrayed by someone, and her response was, okay, well, if, you know, then I'm not going to ever invest my emotions in people again. I'm going to just go for the money. And so this all comes out too in the story. And the lawyer winds up having to take a kind of another look at her own life and what it has become, because she's become very wealthy and very successful, but she's also very alone, and she has, you know, basically no life other than the money, which, you know, I mean, might sound great, but, you know, she's not very happy.
I know, that's so sad. But we get to know her a little bit better whenever.
Yeah.
We won't say how. So we've got the other boss, Kaiser. Why does he show her so much support? And then he lets her get away with a lot that most bosses would say, you know, like, put their, you know, brakes on.
Well, you know, people think he's a big media bear. He owns not only the Channel 10 News, but he owns all sorts of stuff. And people think that people like that are generally very unfeeling and cold and not very good bosses. And he basically is a pretty good guy. And you know, a lot of this is based on my own experience. I mean, I've worked for, you know, like four or five or six big bosses in my life, you know, who've owned massive stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, including Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, people always ask me Murdoch. And I always say, one of the greatest bosses I ever had. I mean, he was always good to me. He treated me well. You know, whatever you think of his politics or whatever, he was like, you know, people think, oh, he's a terrible. No, he's not. He was great. So I wanted to kind of, he comes across as basically as this good person. But the one of the reasons he's there is. So Claire is the news director of the station, which means she's not normally going to go out and cover stories. Now, in the first book, she had to cover the story because it was the story of Lucy Devlin, the girl that she'd won a Pulitzer for. In this one, there has to be a reason why she's covering it, and the reason is because her bosses, Brendan Kaiser's name turns up on this list, and he goes to her and says, look, I know you're an award-winning reporter. I want you to run this story because my name, and I need to find out why my name's on here. So that's kind of why I brought him into it, because it's a reason for Claire to do it. But, yeah, like I didn't want it to be a situation where he was an unsympathetic character, and he's not. And, is, you know, again, he's another one that as you go through the book, you find out that he wasn't always this giant media baron. He was once this young kid who didn't really want to be any part of the business or anything. And you see how he changed over the time, too. And all these people, whether it be the senator or the lawyer or this guy, Kaiser, they all wind up having to kind of look back on their lives and kind of deal with where they were once 30 years ago and where they are now. And the 30 years is because at some point a lot of the answers to whatever happened here happened 30 years ago that nobody even realized at the time. And but it kind of all comes together now around this Grace Mancuso.
Well, that is true.
And if that sounds confusing, then people just got to read the book to figure it out.
Well, that's true. You know, they have all that whole list of people, and you begin to wonder, except for the person that was homeless in Grace Mancuso, you begin to wonder, like, which one of these people are guilty? But then you'll find out
or if any of them
exactly
are guilty.
Are
they all red herrings? And then the other question that comes up is, if one of them was guilty on the list, why would they leave a list with their own name on it, you know, at the murder scene? So these are all good questions, and like I said, I didn't have all the answers when I started writing them, but I sort of like came up with answers that I liked as I went along, and it's not quite as simple as it seems.
This is very true. So we have Grace, who seemed to run hot and cold until she meets Scott Manning. So she gets close to him. So how do they finally lead, you know, I'm not going to say how it leads to a connection with the 6 months.
You're talking about Claire and Scott Manning. Yeah, so Scott Manning is one of the people on the list. He's a police officer, detective, who's basically on suspension at the moment because he was involved in a case where a suspect got thrown out of a window and died. And his partner was accused of doing it, and Scott Manning, basically backed up his partner, and then because as the investigation went on, he was suspended. So that's his status, but he's like still an award-winning, you know, he's still like a detective with all sorts of honors. So Claire goes to speak to him, and she finds out that, among other things, that he's incredibly good-looking and very charming. He also is married, but she's interested in him. And that's one of my favorite exchanges she has with her friend Janet is, you know, after she meets this guy, Scott Manning, and they sort of talk about getting together and having a drink. You know, Janet says something to her like, let me get this straight. The guy is accused of throwing somebody, he's suspended. He's accused of throwing somebody out of a window. He may be a suspect in the Grace Mancuso murder, and he is married, but you still want to go out with him. And Claire's response is, well, he is awfully cute, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of sometimes the way Claire's mind works. And, he winds up kind of partnering up with her in terms of the investigation, also in terms of their personal relationship, but she winds up working with him on the case, which is really pretty irregular since he's theoretically one of the suspects, but because she believes, you know, he didn't do it, she uses him, and she gets a lot of criticism at her station for doing this, but again, she's also drawn by the fact that she's really attracted to him, even though he's married. And, you know, that all plays out through the book. And then he's a big part of it. And then, and right, as you know, to the climactic scene at the end where a lot of it comes together. And it's Claire and Scott Manning together.
I know. And we're getting to wonder if she's going to if she's ever going to settle down. Number four, I don't know about that. Seriously.
Yeah,
I don't know if she. I don't think she's made for number four. Maybe five or six, but you don't know that.
Well, you know, it's an interesting. Yeah. I just just finished the next Claire book, which will be out in 2020, called The Last Scoop. So that won't be out for another year. But obviously, I talk about her relationships and stuff in there, and Scott Manning is back in a role, and other relationships with people. But I mean, this is always. You know, for an author or whatever, it's always a tricky business with the romance because it's like with almost anything. I mean, if you have somebody happily married, it kind of takes away a lot of the drama. So
it gets boring, I know.
Yeah, so having somebody, I mean, it goes all the way back to, remember, the Cheers with Sam and the Shelley Long character, you know. They when they actually finally get together, it's kind of like, okay, it was much more better when they're kind of like bickering and everything. And then, you know, I mean, I always look at the, you know, like the, I was reading one of the early Spencer books by Robert B. Parker, and in those he's kind of like picking up women and stuff. And then at some point he winds up with Susan Silverman, and he's like with her for the whole thing. And they're not married, but, you know, but I mean, it's always a tricky business. Like, should your protagonist, if you have a long series, be married, or should they have all, you know, Harry Bosch has been through all sorts of, you know, trauma and stuff with women, with, you know, women he loved dying with, you know. I just think as an author, it's kind of more interesting and more fun to not make it, to not have a happy ending necessarily.
I know. It's probably more like real life too. Poor people.
Yeah, you don't want them. You don't want them like bickering over, you know, what color wallpaper to put or something. You know, it's better to have, you know, real.
I would let them decide because I don't really care as long as it's got crazy designs and multicolor, and it matches my hair, which is blonde with yellow, with blue, purple, yellow, red, and green streaks. Probably by the time I see you at the Thriller Fest, it'll be different colors. Definitely.
Well,
I'm serious. It's whatever my hairdresser likes to do. I just crack up laughing and go like, oh, is that what I look like this week? Oh, my God.
But I think Claire is one of those people, too, who probably is better living alone because, you know, she talks about some of the incidents involving her husband's and basically says, you know, they were all my fault. But, I mean, she, you know, in the books I have her doing things like, you know, like she's tweeting news stories during while they're in bed having sex, and you know, they, like she's constantly doing stuff with the job, and she's driving her husband's crazy. So, and she pretty much admits that. So, it may be that she's not really suited for anybody, but you know, she is. I mean, I have her basically in her mid-40s, and so you know, she's of that age where. She's been doing this for the last 10 or 15 years, jumping around from men to men. But at what point, you know, does she have to make a decision? And then the other decision, obviously, which has played a role in the thing in the books, is children. You know, what is her role? Does she want to be a mother? Does she want to settle down? So I you know, these are obviously the B stories, obviously, to the Claire books.
Well, before I forget. So I don't want to forget. I'm taking a couple of days off, but Friday at, what did we say, 11? We're going to join, R.G. Belsky and I are going to join Marcia Casper Cook on A Good Story is a Good Story. And you just never know what's going to happen. It's going to be so much fun. And
that's,
on the 16th.
That's Friday, the May 10th, right? That's this Friday, May 10th.
That's
right?
this Friday, yep. Mm-hmm.
Right,
and then
right.
On the 16th, I've got the author of One Small Sacrifice. And on the 28th, someone we all know and love so much, John Land, Murder
right.
in Red, Jessica Fletcher's
back. And One Small
back.
Sacrifice, One Small Sacrifice, that's Hillary Davidson, right?
Yes, it is, and that was really good, too. I just, you know what happened? The publicist just sent it to me, and I go like, huh? Where'd this come from? And
yeah,
then 5
yeah.
minutes later, she said, now that you have the book, when do you want to interview the author? I said, could I have 5 minutes to read the book? No, they gave me 10,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
So someone else you know and love on 6-4, Charles Salzberg, Swans Down.
Yeah.
These books are
yeah.
hilarious. And
yeah.
on the 6th, we've got David R. Dow, Confessions of an Innocent Man. On the 10th, we've got Gabriel Vajon, The Naming Game.
Yeah, I know. I've read that too. Gabriel's a good friend of mine. I just spent some time with him at Malice Domestic, and
oh, good.
If you look on the whatever the name game or the naming game, if you look, when you look at the famous authors that have blurbs, one of them will be me because he asked me to give him to read it. And yeah, that's a fascinating book because it's kind
yeah.
of set in post World War II, and it gets into all this stuff like. Blacklisting and McCarthyism, and really, really, it's a really fun read.
It was, and then on the 12th, we got somebody else we all know and love, The Caregiver's Wife, Vincent Zandri, and that should be interesting. And then there were three more, and one that you're going to be on, which is on the 19th, was going to be Strong Female Characters with you,
yeah.
Alan Topol, John Land, and Philip Margolin. He's joining
yeah,
us.
Yeah, well, you know, Philip Margolin is young. He's a big name. One of my favorite. I mean, one of my favorite thrillers of all time was. He wrote this a long time ago, but Gone But Not Forgotten is an incredible book. Incredible book, yeah. My only problem with John Land is I've been on like a number of shows with you with John Land.
Uh-oh.
And no, you know, I think I've told him. The problem is he's so smart that he says the things I want to say before I can say them. And I wind up agreeing with him. I go, like, everything John just said, I agree with. No, he's really good. And I've been on a couple shows with him. And I'm like, yeah, damn, that was my point. But so he obviously, because he agrees with me, he's clearly a very smart person, you know. But it's interesting how many of those people I know. And I know Hillary. But and obviously I know Charlie. I just read one of the Swan books recently, not the new one. And
I love his books.
Those are great fun. Yeah. So I know. Yeah. No. I know. I know pretty much all of those people.
Well, there's only three more. The 24th, I'm with the new author, Murmur of Bees, and the 26th, I have. Yeah, it's a good question. I just booked somebody for that particular show, and the 17th I've got another panel. I've got Alan Jacobson, Stephen J. Schwartz, Lee Goldberg, Lawrence Black, and Tess Gerrinson, Hollywood versus the author.
All right, now let me tell you something. Lee Goldberg is one of the most. I'm sure you probably have talked to him. He is maybe one of the most entertaining people I have ever talked
really?
To in my entire life. Oh, because you know Lee. Well, first off, he writes great books. I read his last one, True Fiction. He's got another one out
me
now.
Me too.
And but he has the, you know, he spent most of his career, a lot of it in Hollywood. He was like the I think the executive producer of Diagnosis Murder. He wrote
yep.
a lot of screenplays for Monk. You know, he's done all this TV stuff, and he is a he was at Thriller Fest with us last year, and you go to one of his panels, he is just he's got story after story, and just I interviewed him for the Big Thrill magazine, and he might have been the most interesting interview I've ever done, so that'll be great.
It should be interesting, and the one I just was the 627 Emily Eternal, she's an artificial consciousness. It should be interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's just, and then Fran takes off July completely, just doing book reviews, no shows, and going to the Thriller Fest. Yes, I hope I get
but
to
we'll
be there.
We'll see you at Thriller Fest. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, I got invited. I got lucky, yeah. And then I start back in August. So before we go, we have Dora. Tell us a little bit about Dora and her backstory, and then
yeah.
things get dangerous for Claire, and we get to worry that something's going to happen to her.
Well, I mean, Dora, so the homeless woman, basically, people only know her as, she calls herself Cinderella because she said, oh, I'm like Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
my Prince Charming is going to come. But then we find out her name is really Dora Gale, and she's this, you know, like, unpleasant-looking woman who's an alcoholic and things like that before she's found dead. But then we go back, and one of the things that really motivates Claire to start looking into it is that she finds an old yearbook picture of Dora Gale when she attended NYU, and she's, like, stunningly beautiful. I mean, she was this, you know, just this gorgeous young, and underneath it, it talks about how she loves poetry, and she wants to, you know, she wants to write as a, you know, literature, and she had all these dreams and aspirations, and, you know, she was like a lot of people, and so that's, we don't then know, we then have like a huge gap. At some point between that, when
mm-hmm.
she's like 21 years old until the current, there's a little bit of a trail where she winds up working some menial jobs. Eventually she becomes an
mm-hmm.
alcoholic. She winds up on social, you know, on welfare for a while. And then at the end, she's on the street. And you never know exactly what happened over those 30 years, but clearly this is a woman whose life just spiraled out of control. And at the end of the book, Claire actually, even though she's very sympathetic toward the Dora Gale woman, she's actually mad at her too, because she actually says at the end, she says, you know, Dora Gale had choices she could have made. There are a lot of bad things that happened to her, but like all of us, she had choices, and she made choices that, you know, resulted in her self-destruction when she could have made other choices. So it was sad, but, you know, to some degree, she had allowed her life to degenerate to the point where she wound up as a homeless person.
I know.
And then there are so many people that want to be homeless, though. Yeah, and then Claire's, well, we actually find an interview with her for some documentary with Dora Gale where she actually says, like, hey, I just want to sit in the park. I want to just have, you know, drink. But she's a little different than a lot of homeless because, she will go into a bar and the bartender will maybe give her free bottles because he says, like, oh, she was a very classy lady. She would quote literature to me. You know what I mean? Things like that. So that's why it was kind of sad. And in terms of Claire being in danger, I mean, you know, well, you gotta have the heroine in danger at some point. So yes, there's a lot of stuff that happens, but there certainly is that climactic scene at the end, you know, where she's in the throes of us. And you know, it's an interesting thing because when you have a protagonist who's like a reporter like mine. It's you know, having them in danger or putting like in a climactic violent scene is not as easy as like if they're a police officer or a PI because they don't carry a gun or anything like that. So they have to be kind of the victim in a situation that that they're able to get out of, and that's sort of what happens in Below the Fold.
I know, it was so sad. The ending was very sad too. So does Claire, is she gonna ever learn the truth about what happened? And where do you see her next? And you said Scott's coming back, but
I don't think
she's ready to be close to him as a permanent person. Not really. I don't think
I mean, there's in the new book called The Last Scoop, it involves basically, I mean, it's a whole new different story, obviously, but there's a couple of recurring things. I mean, this is basically, we're talking about the next book now, it's a year from now, and that involves an old mentor of hers, a journalist who dies mysteriously and has secrets about a serial killer, and she winds up actually tracking a serial killer like a kind of a Ted Bundy, and it's, you know, you really... takes her around the country, you know, looking for this person who's been killing all these women over a period of years. But there's two, and it was great because I really got a chance to do a lot of research into like Son of Sam and Ted Bundy, Son of Sam, which I covered, and Ted Bundy, and some of the other big, you know, Zodiac, and you know, because it's kind of a fun thing. The stories aren't fun, but they're fun. It's interesting to write about his fiction. But there's two recurring themes in here, one of which is Scott Manning is still around, and he's still married, and so there's still this pull and tug between her and Scott Manning that goes on throughout the book. But the other, obviously, thing that goes on, and I don't want to talk too much about this because, you know, this comes this is sort of what goes on in the first book, but the whole Lucy Devlin situation, you know, with the child that went missing and the secrets Claire had about it, and she doesn't get all the answers to that in book one. She gets some more answers in book two, but she's dealing with that again in book three. And like I said, if you read the first book, you know that she won a Pulitzer for covering the Lucy Devlin story, which is the disappearance of a little 11-year-old girl off the streets of New York. But her connection to the story is, you know, much more powerful and much more personal even than that. And that stays with her in the second book, Below the Fold, but also in the third book, where she's still looking for answers not only about Lucy Devlin, but most of all about herself and, you know, what about her own life.
Well, there were other characters in the book that I didn't mention that get killed and are dead. And then there's somebody close to one of the other characters, and I said, oh, really? You know, because they learn more about Dora and, you know, who's related to her. But I didn't mention that person because they're going to have to find out who that is afterwards.
It's tough to talk too much about the, too much about the story. Without giving stuff away, but I do like the fact that I believe that in the book most people who've read it, I mean, you, at some point you think you've figured it out, but you probably haven't figured it out because, you know, I think it goes in a different direction. And I, you know, I'm sort of guilty of trying to lead you in one direction and then sort of trying to pull the rug out from under you and saying, oops, sorry, none of that is really true. And,
that's true.
You know,
and the connection was interesting. I go like, oh, okay, I got that, but you don't know who's doing what.
Well, you know, and one of the things about what turns out to be the connection between the six, I don't think it's giving anything away, of all these people on the list, is it turns out to be a not a momentous thing, I like this idea that there can be a moment in time where different people all are in one place at one time, and it seems like it doesn't mean anything, but it could have significant impact, you know, many years later. And that's kind of what happens in the book.
Oh, I agree with you. That's true. But how did you create the interviews? How did you create the interviews?
Which interviews?
The interviews with the interviews in this, and how she can tell the issues of homeless, the interviews of the homeless, and trust and sexual misconduct and everything. There were so many. How did you manage to have so many of them, you know, in this book and keep your interest?
Yeah. Well, like I say, I think to some degree they were all different because you had the homeless, then it's always fun to write about sex scandals. So the stuff with the senator was, or the congressman, was really easy to do. And they're all different. Like the lawyer who had been who was a money grubber but who used to be very idealistic. I like that idea of somebody who could kind of sold out. And and like I say, I think the character of the media boss, her boss, is really interesting too, because, you know, it's like he wasn't some guy who decided I want to be the most powerful media baron in the world. He was a guy who had other aspirations who wound up getting pushed into it because of the family situation, and I like that idea too. So each of the characters that happened, and also even the Scott Manning character with the backstory about standing up for his partner, they're all different kinds of stories. So I was able to to kind of create each character to have a different backstory that somehow all comes together in one by the end of the book.
Well, the last line in the book is just so perfect. I have to read this thing.
Sure.
I love Dora. And everybody that's ever read Cinderella loves Cinderella, because Cinderella is great. I don't love Snow White's story because I thought it was too violent. And some of them. And some of the fairy tales, I mean, I taught reading and writing. I was a staff developer for a long time, and I was the dean. And I did Hansel and Gretel with my reading group. And I tried to explain to them that, I asked them this moral question. Did Hansel and Gretel do something wrong when they pushed the witch in the oven? Wasn't that murder? Or do you think she got what she deserved? And that was interesting, because basically, either way, you're wrong. She says she was right about believing in fairy tales. And sometimes, you want to believe in fairy tales because you want life to be perfect. But unfortunately, it wasn't. But in Dora's mind, she was Cinderella. How did you create that? We have about 5 minutes. Why Cinderella? I love Cinderella. Cinderella is just so perfect.
I guess just, I don't really know. I mean, the actual original title of the book was called The Cinderella Murders.
That makes sense.
I had it in mind, yeah. It's just, I wanted, it captured this idea of this woman who still had this dream of a fairy tale that some Prince Charming was going to, even though it was so crazy that in her life, she wasn't like just living on the street and thinking I have no life. She had come up with this fairy tale, and living in the fairy tale was just easier, I guess. And I don't remember exactly how I came up with Cinderella, but I mean, it just seemed like a thing. But I think that the thing in the ending that you're talking about there, where Claire basically is talking about how she still believed in fairy tales, and Claire is like relating to it because it's, to a degree she's thinking herself like, well, I sort of want to believe in fairy tales too. I want to believe I'll live happily ever after. And one of the things that happens through this book is, even though she never knows Dora Gale, she really relates to Dora Gale. You know, she begins to know her through all this stuff she's found, and she's mad at her because of the things she did, but she also like feels sorry for her. And I think at one point at the end of the book, she says something like, Dora Gale is the one I feel the worst about. You know, I miss that she's not here because, like, she had found her to be such a fascinating character. And as the book goes through, to me, that's one of the things I was the proudest of, that I took this homeless woman on the street that seemed totally uninteresting. And as the book goes on, you really have you have a lot of sympathy for her. She's got all these hopes and dreams, and she's beautiful. And, you know, again, it's like people don't start out as 60-year-old homeless dead people on the street. They start out as somebody who was trying to live a life, and they wind up there. And that's kind of the story I told. It is a sad story involving Dora Gale, but you know, I thought it made her like a much more interesting character to create.
Well, you made her more humanized. But the other line that I love is, you have to make your own fairy tales come true.
Yeah,
and you know what? You have to decide. It's hard sometimes to decide what you want. And sometimes you look forward and you say to yourself, okay, is that going to happen? And it doesn't. And you wonder, you know, if the Wicked Queen from The Wizard of Oz is really, you know, after you. or if Prince Charming. So maybe, before I ask you where we can find out more about you and your work. So is Claire...
Yeah.
You know, does she ever? How would she describe her own Prince Charming? Would she? Does she even know what her Prince Charming? I mean, she's married three times, and now she's got with Scott.
Yeah,
I don't blame her. He's hot.
I think she's had a lot of Prince Charmings.
I
don't know. I think she's clearly attracted to men like Scott Manning, who are kind of, you know, good looking and interesting and superficial in some ways. I don't know if Claire knows. I don't know if I know Claire well enough yet to know exactly what she's looking for. But like I said, I do think it makes it more interesting to have her keep being on the prowl than having her. You know, I don't know if she'll live happily ever. I think she's happy. But I don't know if she'll live happily ever after in the traditional sense.
I agree with you. I think she's very happy just being like, you know, freelance girlfriend or freelance whatever.
Right.
So where
right.
can everybody learn more about your work? And I can't wait to get the arc. You're doing this with Ocean View, right?
Yeah, yeah. So there'll be an arc for the next one probably. Yeah, you'll be on the list, friend. We'll be, I think it's generally like late summer or early fall, something like that.
Yeah, I know. I open my mailbox and I never know what's going to be there. It's so amazing. So amazing. I never know anything. It just shows up and I go like, oh my God, I've got, you know, 8 books on my chair because I lessened the pile finally. And I put the other 21 in the bag, and most of them are from Ocean View and some of them are not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm reading, for those people that want to know what they should read below the fold, I'm reading The Last Second by J.T. Ellison and Catherine Coulter. I just got that. And a phenomenal book that was sent to me as a surprise, The Never Game by Jeffrey Deaver. That was absolutely,
Jeffrey Deaver.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Deaver's, he's big, Well, let me tell you real quickly a few things about, just where, people can find out. So my website is www.rgbelsky.com.
Okay.
And you can also find me at RG Belsky on Facebook if you want, or but if you go on my website, it'll pretty much give you all the information. And if you get a chance, there's I don't know if you're familiar. There's a really good mystery writer named James Siskin who writes books, and he interviewed me this month for the current issue of the Big Thrill magazine. And it's not so much me, but he did a terrific job of creating this scene with us talking in a bar about crime writing and Claire and a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, it's two journalists talking. And so it's in the Big Thrill magazine. So it's a big interview with me. If you're really interested, it'll tell you a lot about me there. So that's the best places to check.
And if you keep putting books on Facebook that you like to read, I'm going to be in big trouble. Because I don't know if it was you or Vincent Zandri that put Chris Pavone and the Paris Diversion. I just finished reviewing it, and he loved it. I just read it. And every time I see you put a book out, or Matt Coyle put a book out, or anybody that puts a book out that I don't have, I go like, when, why don't I have it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm getting in so much trouble, yet I'm getting about six more books. But all I want to thank you so much. This has been fun. And
thanks,
Ren. You're very welcome. And we're gonna—I'll be joining you Friday. You're the lead interview. I'm just there.
Yeah. I'll be there. We'll talk Friday, and then I'll be back with you for the female protagonist next month.
Yes, you will be on June 19th at 11 o'clock. R.G. Belsky and Philip Margolin, John Landon. We'll be there, and Alan Topol, which should be interesting. Thank you
that's
so
a good,
much.
That's a good lineup.
I hope so. So I will talk to you then. Everybody have a great day. The sun is outside. It's beautiful, and bye.
Bye-bye.